I was thinking about these folks out on the patio. I wonder how they looked at the guys out on the tee as they were out there. Yeah. They can't hear the music, but we can. Oh, boy. Okay. So we'll, tomorrow afternoon session on Saturday, we'll do the same thing, because it's even worse tomorrow afternoon, boy, I'm telling you. By tomorrow at this time, you'll just be excited. Okay, now let me get to my assignment. My assignment this afternoon is to speak about step number 2 in the 12 and 12. And it would be wonderful if I had my book. Thank you, Pete. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I know the step, but as Willie mentioned this morning, some of the history of the writing of the big book, when it was done, the time span between the big book and the writing of the 12 and 12, important to remember that. I mean, you know, things have perspective, and it's important for me to have this knowledge. And knowledge, education is not for the purpose of knowledge, but it's for the purpose of action. You know what I'm saying? It's getting all this information for you and I is not going to do us a dead blame bit of good unless we are able to put it into action. And that's the only thing that we can... There it is. Thank you very much. And that's the only thing we can't do is provide that inner desire to put it into your own life so that you claim it and you own it. All we can do here is provide some information that we know is valuable. We have enough experience in these seminars now that we're not concerned about whether it's going to work or not, or whether it's valuable and whether it's exciting and whether it's worthwhile. We know that. So we just need to be clear and integrous with you to say that all the information is valuable and good, but it's only so good as you apply it to your own life. So, but what we try to do, and what's been wonderful for me in these seminars, is the way of understanding has been cleared. I've been able to just say to myself, as I sit here, let me just listen. Let me just get this noise out of my head. Let me listen and see if perhaps I can hear something that I can use to move me forward. I'm not sitting here to argue with or to dissect. I used to do this. I used to sit there and check everybody out. When they said something and they quoted that book, I'd write it down real fast and I'd go home and pull my dusty book off the shelf and see if they were right about it. That's where I came from. You know, it's always about proving you wrong or right and all, but that's not the purpose of the exercise. And also, the 12 and 12 is written to not as a replacement for the big book. It's very clear on page 17 in the forward. Paraphrasing, it says something to the effect that the big book is the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous, always has been, always will be. This little volume is to enhance your understanding of that book. It's not to be used in place of, it's to be used in conjunction with. You want to see some new information and some new ways of thinking in Bill's mind between the time he wrote, with the help of the first 100, that big book, and the 12 and 12, you see some differences. Some major differences, some good differences, some positive differences, which allow you and I to understand this thing, because Bill Wilson starts talking about basic, natural, God-given instincts, which are not mentioned in the big book. And by reading and allowing the enhancement to take place by understanding and studying the 12 and 12, I see that as a human being, I'm just like every other human being. I'm not different from you. I'm not any worse or not any better than. We're all basically the same thing, because according to my understanding of that, as you were born, so was I, with these natural God-given instincts for survival, for security, and for sex. It's just the way it is. But when, you know, I went to school, I learned the formulas of an algebra, and I knew how to add and subtract. I learned some of the history, but then people didn't teach me how to really live and understand my natural instincts. They don't teach that in school. They don't teach you about living in school. And, it seems like I went to the School of Hard Knocks and then graduated to the University of Adversity. Because of my alcoholism. So here, this book is designed to enhance the understanding of those things. Step two does not, as I finally saw it after being in a study group for a long period of time and going through this thing, I finally saw very clear what Bill Wilson was trying to tell us. And he says, in a sense, that every alcoholic who comes to AA has an attitude about believing. Every one of us has an attitude about believing in this power source. And he categorizes them in five ways. He said that every alcoholic seems to walk through that door. When we talk about believing in a power greater than yourself, there is an attitude there with that individual. And he describes them for us. And their wonderful self-knowledge, self-information is great, but it's also good if you're working with other folks. It's nice to kind of hear and know where they're coming from in terms of these attitudes so that you can help them overcome that attitude and get them through this wall of denial or a wall of ignorance, perhaps, that's bothering them about believing. Because some of us, at least in my case, I had a warped idea about this when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not downplaying my upbringing, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. It's just the way it was. But by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had developed some pretty abnormal ideas about a power source that don't even line up with the way it is today. I had begun to interpret God as He was when I was raised in my early child, in my impressionable years when I was being educated by my mother in the church, that God was sort of like the one that Charlie was speaking about. You know, the rights and the wrongs and the do's and the don'ts. And if you mess up, it's nothing but pure living hell for you. I remember as a child when I broke my left arm at the age of about 12 years old, I remember my first question to myself was this: well, I wonder what I did wrong to deserve this. I just thought that was the way. Anytime I experienced pain, it was a way of punishment. See, that's how I began to determine stuff. And it's not that my training was bad or good. It's not about that. It's just the way I filtered that information. And I see a lot of us filter it the same way. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, when it came to this kind of an area, I had no quarrel with God. I was an agnostic. But I certainly wasn't where it seemed you folks were with respect to that. When I looked at the steps and I saw the first one that said something about God, which really was the third step, the next step, I just said it looks like an altar call to me. I want nothing to do with that. I said to myself, being raised as a Baptist, I was later converted to Catholicism. I said to myself, man, I've been sprinkled and I've been dunked and it don't work for me. I thought, I just didn't think it worked. I'd had a double dipping, you know what I'm saying? And so that wasn't the answer. But what it was not... I heard Charlie say something very profound. First time I ever heard him say anything from... No. But he said something very profound a while ago at lunch. He said something about alcoholism was not as a result of denial. It's a result of ignorance. Most folks who want to continue to drink, they do it based on ignorance. They don't know that they don't know that they don't know that they don't know. So you and I, all of us in here, guess what? The world didn't change and the universe didn't change just because we stopped drinking, did it? We gained and gathered new information, which we decided to take a different direction based on the new information. And that's really what it's all about, information. So that's why the power of the seminars is such that we get here and get real clear in the understanding. See, I'm very grateful to the folks like Charlie and Joe who have a very unique understanding and a wonderful way of communicating that program, so that when you listen to them, you just see light bulbs going off, and you feel them going off, and you say, that's it. Why, you know, boom, you want to, why didn't I see that? God, it's so clear. That's why I like study groups, because in that arena, the dialogue of several alcoholics trying to focus on the same thing and speaking about it, we come to a greater understanding of it. And if I understand it, I can apply it, see? And that's what we're all doing here, is gaining new information. so that we can apply it to our life, because it's ultimately our responsibility. It's on my shoulders. But with this, let me get back to this step, because I have been admonished once or twice by my peers about getting way off the step. So I need to stay pretty close to it. But I don't think I stray too far when I talk about belief systems. And really, that's what the step is about. It just talks about coming to believe. And I have come to understand beliefs and thinking and thoughts as the thing that moves me and moves all other human beings. Everything we are is based on thinking. Everything. Everything is thought. Everything is thinking. And I have found, to the degree that I get rid of negative thinking and put in positive thinking, I show up differently. And I'm really into the alteration of my belief system. And in the recovery process, the first time we have a chance to look at it is in this step. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And when we come here, we all have an attitude or a belief about God. It's just a done deal. And even as we sit here today, all of us have an attitude and a belief about God. It's not about right and wrong. It's just about what will enable you to move forward in your life and maximize it so that you can be a maximum service to God and to your fellow man, because that's the goal. That's the mission here. Alcoholics Anonymous only exists beyond getting me sober is so that I fulfill my obligation to pass that on to somebody else. And that's all. That's it. But Bill Wilson was he saw basic characteristics of all alcoholics in those 14 or so years, that when they came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you got into the belief system with respect to God as you understand Him, they had one of these attitudes. And in the book, we'll start taking a little look at them. The first one was about a belligerent individual. Now, I know there's probably nobody in Broward County today that has that kind of an attitude, but just in case, I'm going to just put them on the screen as I have extracted them from the book. Now, you folks way in the back, don't worry, I'll speak about them. The first one is the belligerent one, the one who says he won't believe. On page 25, line 13, you'll find that one described. That's how I knew there were five, because of the writing of the books. Look, first, I knew that's number one, right? That gave me a clue. He's in a state of mind which can only be described as savage. His whole philosophy of life, in which he's so glorified, is threatened. It's bad enough, he thinks, to admit that alcohol has him down for keeps, but now, still smarting from that admission, he's faced with something really impossible. How he does cherish the thought that man, risen so majestically from a single cell, and the primordial ooze is the spearhead of evolution, and therefore the only God that his universe knows. Must he renounce all this to save his life? Now, what a dilemma that alcoholic must be in. Bad enough to give up that booze, and now you're going to ask me to do this. So he's a belligerent one, is at war. And then the sponsor. This is where they start using the technique of the sponsor. The sponsor is going to overcome this. And you'll notice how some of us in recovery today, rather than admonishing or chewing anybody out face to face, or saying something that might hurt somebody's feelings, we always say it this way. Well, I don't know about you, but my sponsor told me, da, 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 da. Now, if you want to get what I got, you'll do what my sponsor said. You'll da, 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 do, do, da. You know what I'm saying? That way you're not being the putting yourself in a position of superiority. It's never you, it's that dad-blamed sponsor of yours. Wonderful technique here, see? So down towards the middle of page 26, he gives us the answer to this. First, now this is a sponsor speaking, because you can see that in the beginning of the paragraph, talking about the sponsor. That agrees the sponsor is a very good question. Okay, how do you take it easy? That was a question. It says, first, Alcoholics Anonymous does not demand that you believe anything. All of its 12 steps are but suggestions. Second, to get sober and stay sober. You don't have to swallow all of step two right now. Looking back, I found it, I took it piecemeal myself. Third, all you really need is a truly open mind. Just resign yourself from the debating society. Quit worrying about what came first, the chicken or the hen. You know what I'm saying? Or the egg. They came together, didn't they? Okay. I heard that. That's not me. I heard that. I'm repeating that. Oh, my. So the sponsor steps in with a guy with this attitude, and then continuing on page 27 towards the bottom. This is only one man's opinion based on his own experience. I must quickly assure you that AA treads innumerable paths in their quest for faith. If you don't care for the one I've suggested, you can discover one that suits you if only you look and listen. Many a man like you has begun to solve the problem by the method of substitution. And this is where they suggest we substitute the group, for example, as a power greater than yourself. That's what I had to do in the beginning. The group represented a power greater than myself in that all of those folks there, most of them, were all sober. It says, all of them, once you tell, all of them will tell you that once across, that is, once the decision is made, their faith broadened and deepened. Relieved of the alcohol obsession, their lives unaccountably transformed. They came to believe in a higher power, and most of them began to talk of God. So the first attitude that one has is one that's at war with God. He's belligerent. And then the book tells us how to overcome it. Three little steps. You don't have to swallow it all now. Take it easy. You don't have to jump through the eye of a needle right now. And then they come to the next one. I know this is next because that's a word in there. It says, consider next. So that's number two. The plight of those who had faith but lost it. Now, it's a very common thing that I've run into in working with other alcoholics is that like a lot of us, we had sort of an upbringing that almost required some kind of immersion into some religious training, either going to church or going to church schools or whatever the case may be. It was part of my routine. I just sort of forced into it. I didn't have much choice about it in those days. And so it was with a lot of beliefs that I evolved and developed. So what I'm beginning to do here in step two is to investigate the beliefs that I am and always have been to see if they're working for me. And I know they're not working. I know they're not working. All I got to look around is the room I'm in at 8:30 most nights. My belief systems did not work because I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So what I'm beginning to do now is to investigate these belief systems that evolved, and I'm beginning to take a look at them and realizing that a lot of the beliefs that I have, and here again, it's not about right or wrong, it's just what is. My training, my upbringing, my mother instilled in me certain beliefs and values. The schools instilled in me certain beliefs and values. The church did the same thing. My peers did the same thing, so that on any time, at any day that I want to measure myself, if it were today, the time is now and the place is here, if I examine my belief system, they're the sum total of all the choices and decisions, et cetera, that I made up until this very moment. Until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I say they weren't bad choices, they're the only choices I could make based on the information I had. I declare that I never made a bad choice. I do not intentionally, I don't think most human beings will ever make a knowingly bad choice. They'll make a choice that doesn't turn out the way they thought it would, but it's not a bad choice. It's the only choice they could make given the information they were dealing with at that time. So I'm not going to beat myself up about that. So I would suggest you don't do it either. That in the belief systems that I am, that this is just the beginning of taking a look at it. Finding out what makes me tick. And I was one of those who had faith but lost it. And as I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, as I told you, I was an agnostic. Because I wouldn't argue with you about God, but please let you and I not discuss it. If that's your belief, that's fine and dandy. I know there's probably some supreme being, but hey, he hadn't been in touch with me lately. And so I would not argue with you. But I thought I was an agnostic and said so. But I found out what I really was about 6 months into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as I was riding around listening to my radio. It was one of these talk shows coming out of Miami. They had two guests, and these were rabbis on the program. I wasn't paying a lot of attention to it. I just had it on and was, you know, my mind must have been elsewhere. But I did remember that about halfway into the program, this is the time they asked for call-ins to make comments. I guess these guys had been talking about something, and then they asked for comments. And the first guy that called in said that he was an agnostic. And of course, when I heard that word, being about 6 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, it kind of got my attention. I said, there's another one. There's two of us anyway. And then I heard this rabbi ask this guy a couple of questions. He says, let me ask you a couple of questions about that. He says, have you ever studied the Old Testament to try to understand things of this nature? And the guy says, no, I haven't done that. Rabbi says, well, let me ask you this. Have you ever taken any kind of training that would allow you to understand things of this nature? And the guy said, no, I haven't done that either. And the rabbi said, well, son, you're not an agnostic, you're an ignoramus. So then I knew what I was. I was an ignoramus. I just didn't know that I did not know. But had faith but lost it. Page 28. There will be those who have drifted into indifference, those filled with self-sufficiency who have cut themselves off, those who have become prejudiced against religion, and those who are downright defiant because God has failed to fulfill their demands. Prejudice comes from the word of prejudge. I never thought about myself as being prejudiced until I really found out what the definition of that word was. Prejudge. Contempt prior to investigation. Decisions based on no information. I mean, I didn't realize how prejudiced I was. I found out that I can be prejudiced even in sobriety. Have you prejudged anything or anybody in the last 2 or 3 days? It runs rampant. So that's what prejudice means. It's not about liking and disliking. It's not a race. It's just prejudging. That's what that word means, to prejudge. I don't want to be that anymore. Because this step allowed me to open up to the idea that, as I mentioned earlier, we're all alike. Got the same manufacturer, the same manufacturing process, same equipment, basically, when we talk about instincts. You got them, I got them. If we're all alike, why would I not promote your excellence and your power? Why would I not see that in you? Because if I see that in you, it's got to be here. See? So I don't want to be that way no more. Because I'm beginning to see that all human beings are a reflection of me. You've got the same potential and excellence. That's why what Charlie said was so, it hit me right between the eyes a while ago. The alcoholism is not a matter of denial, it's a matter of ignorance. Now that I've gotten some authentic information about recovery and about a power greater than myself, I'm beginning to understand this. I'm beginning to see, when I mentioned yesterday synchronicity, which is a theory that Carl Jung came up with, how absolutely right he was. Have you ever had anything happen to you that you sort of felt? Have you ever had deja vu? Or have you ever heard the phone ring and you knew instantly who was calling you? That's that kind of stuff I'm talking about. It happens. That's synchronicity. Forces moving in the universe that seem unrelated come together. Alcoholics Anonymous is based on that if you study our history. And it's a wonderful hodgepodge of things that were going on that just finally came together. And you know, some of us are sort of pragmatic people, and there's nothing wrong with being pragmatic, you know, especially with respect to this belief business, because it's easy for us, for example, to see a girl pulling a bicycle down the street or pulling a wagon behind her. You see the connection between the girl walking and the wagon moving because you suddenly see the string connected to the wagon. Don't have any problem understanding that connection, do we? Okay, then let's move to the you walk into a room and you throw a switch and suddenly it illuminates with light. Well, although you can't see that connection, you don't have any trouble understanding that from that box to these lights, there's these wires that go through these pipes, to da da do da boo ba ba, and it gets to the energy, and then all of a sudden that lights those lights up. That's not too hard to understand. Then you're sitting on your couch, and you don't like the television show you're watching, you pick up this little box, and you flip a button, and the picture changes. Where's the connection? I don't understand that. I do not understand that. Kid's playing with one of these remote control cars. He's got a little box in his hand. The car's about 30 feet away. He wants that car to turn left. He pushes a little button here to the left. There, that car goes that way. Where's the connection? I don't understand that. I can't see that. I don't understand. But you know, haven't we almost accepted that stuff that we can't see as being just commonplace? How many of us got flickers on them TV sets? How does that work? Where is that thing that connects that TV to that box? How about people who talk to each other? Somebody, you sit there and you're listening and you see my lips moving and you can translate this lip moving business to something that makes sense, I hope, but you can't see that which causes it. They call sound waves. Can you see that? You can't see that. Where's that connection? They come in these ears. They go to the eardrums. Vibrations are set up. Go to the mind and the brain, and they're turned into voices or sounds that you can interpret. I can't see that. How does that happen? But yet, you think about that when you get somebody that says, I can't believe in that nonsense. I can't see it, so therefore it must not be. There's a lot of stuff around us that we can't see the connection, but it's just commonplace, secondary stuff anymore, isn't it? We don't even think about it. So when you're talking to an agnostic like me, and I got to have this proof business, just remind me, there's a lot of connections that I can't see that are happening. But the forces that are at work, and God's that invisible force, seemingly. He's not invisible. I mean, God's in this room, and He's represented by each and every one of us. I also want to share with something. I picked this up not too long ago. I've got to share this with you. The difference between a spiritual being and a non-spiritual being. Listen to some of these. I got these out of another book that Alcoholics Anonymous allows me to further my spiritual search. A spiritual being, for example, will utilize multi-dimensional thinking. Multi-dimensional. A non-spiritual person limits his senses to belief, limits his beliefs and thoughts to the five senses. If I can hear it, if I can smell it, if I can taste it, if I can touch it, it must be, but that's as far as I'll go with it. A spiritual person believes that loving guidance is available. A non-spiritual person believes that we're always alone. A spiritual being focuses on authentic personal empowerment. A non-spiritual person focuses on demanding external power. A spiritual person feels connected to all humanity. A non-spiritual one feels separate from all others. A spiritual person knows a dimension beyond cause and effect. Don't we talk about that in our book? A fourth dimension? A sixth sense? A non-spiritual person believes excessively in cause and effect. A spiritual person is motivated by ethics, serenity, and quality of life. A non-spiritual person is motivated by achievement, performance, and acquisitions. A spiritual being practices meditation. A non-spiritual person rejects meditation. A spiritual individual understands intuition as God talking. A non-spiritual person views intuition as unpredictable hunches. A spiritual individual feels a sense of responsibility and belonging to the universe and awe of being here. A A non-spiritual person feels no sense of responsibility or belonging to the universe. Spiritual individual lives a life of forgiveness, but a non-spiritual person holds grudges and seeks revenge for perceived wrongdoings until he does a fourth step. I added that a little bit. A spiritual individual believes in being able to manifest miracles. A non-spiritual person believes in limitations. Miracles are unpredictable, lucky occurrences. So those are some of the major differences between a spiritual and a non-spiritual individual. What time did I get through here? Oh, good. I only went through two so far. I got a little story I just got to share with you before we finish, but I just want to make sure I have enough time to do that. Number three, page 29. Now we come to another kind of problem. The intellectually self-sufficient man or woman. I found out about that one when I was in the big book and they were describing someone as being precocious. I didn't know what that word meant. And then I went to it and it was someone who seemed to be too smart for their own good or too smart for their age or overly intelligent for whatever. And I began to wonder why nobody had ever called me precocious. And then I came to this portion of the belief system and saw that that I fit here too. I've already belonged to the first two. I mean, I had those attitudes about believing, belligerency, and I'd had a faith but lost it, and now I found, by golly, I was this too. When I went to college and I took anthropology and I knew that religion was self-made and man-made, and if it wasn't here today, we'd invent it again, and so therefore it wasn't valuable. And I'd say, here, look at my ring. I graduated from FSU. I'm smart. I know stuff. That's where I learned about that stuff. I was tough when I came out of college. I mean, I had that sense of intelligence. And I didn't have it. I mean, I've since become humble enough to know that. But I thought automatically, if you get a college degree, that puts you in some level of intelligence. Wrong. And here again, all I needed to do, if I was so smart, I'd say to myself, and my sponsor, Wesley, said this to me. First of all, he said, John, you got to get stupid. That's what he told me I had to do. He said it in a loving way. He wasn't being mean. He just said, John, you just got to get stupid. You got to just wipe the slate. Your computer needs some new software, so we got to get rid of that stuff. And so I understood what he said, because I had this sense of knowing too much. And he just said, well, in the sense, you got to get stupid. And by doing that and becoming stupid, I became teachable. And it says, but the point of the thing was that all I had to do was look around and see where I was. If I was so smart, what was I doing in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, that was the real test. How did I get myself into this jackbox if I'm so smart? Top of page 30, we saw we had to reconsider or die. We found many in AA who once thought as we did. They helped us to get down to our right size. By their example, and they showed us that humility and intellect could be compatible, provided that we placed humility first. When we began to do that, we received a gift of faith, a faith that works, a faith that is for you also. So can't you see how these are wonderful tools in working with other folks? That you don't have to be the expert at it. You just say, come on, let's you and I read this little book together. I see you here. You're described right here. You're one of these intellectually self-sufficient people. Let's see what they had to say about you and me. And the fourth proposition, or the fourth type, or the fourth attitude, is those who say we're plumb disgusted with religion and all of its works. Now see, they come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they form this first opinion that this must be some religious outfit. And I just began to wonder, how could they ever get such an opinion? until I realized that that's the same opinion I had when I got here. Because I was very perceptive. Very perceptive. And I noticed when I walked in the rooms and I sat in the back with my arms folded as I judged all of you, that I noticed that that meeting had started with a moment of silence. And then they said some kind of a prayer. I don't know what it was, but they said something. I know they all had their heads bowed. I was watching them. And then somebody got up there and talked. It sounded to me like salvation. He was headed in the wrong way. He saw the light and he turned around and hallelujah. Ain't it wonderful? And then I noticed that everybody just enjoyed the hell out of that and they clapped and so on and so forth. And then the kicker was this. They picked up these little baskets and started passing them around and these folks put money in them baskets. And I'm saying to myself, where did I see that the last time? So I said, I don't want nothing to do with that. Thank you. I've been there, and it didn't work. So I formed an opinion or an idea about who you were based on false information, based on a belief system that was not working. So you'll find some like me who come in and see that happening, and they'll form that quick opinion about who we are. And, you know, all you got to do is go to two or three meetings, and you find out that that's not true. Because probably the second meeting I went to, I heard somebody up there using profane language that I knew they'd never use in the church. So I said, well, that can't be here. So I knew that that's not what you were. And then as time goes on, I began to listen a little bit more intently and figured it out. But I can see how somebody would draw that conclusion. And here's the other one, the one who says he's full of faith but still smells of alcohol. Now, every now and then you'll get some of these around. They'll come in I'm not being facetious about this, but we have some of these folks who go to other places and they think that they, just because they were like me, that they got sprinkled or dunked, that it's over with. And they, how can this be happening to me? I mean, I got dunked. And it was just 6 weeks ago, but I've been drunk ever since. Well, we see the answer to that here. And it basically boils down to this, that it is not the quantity of faith, but it's the quality of faith. And that's really what it is, isn't it? Even for you and I today. The answer has to do with the quality of faith rather than quantity. This has been our blind spot. We supposed that we had humility when we really didn't. We supposed we had been serious about religious practices when, upon honest appraisal, we found that we'd been only superficial. Or going to the other stream, we had wallowed in emotionalism and had mistaken it for true religious feeling. I've been there. In both cases, we had been asking something for nothing. The fact was that we really hadn't cleaned the house so that the grace of God could enter and expel the obsession. In no deep or meaningful sense had we ever taken stock of ourselves, made amends to those we had harmed, and freely given to any other human being without any demand or reward. See, this is the voice of experience speaking. We had not even prayed right. We had always said, grant my wishes, Santa Claus, instead of thy will be done. The love of God and man we understood not at all. Therefore, we remained self-deceived. And so incapable of receiving enough grace to restore us to sanity. Grace, an unearned gift. That's what I understand that grace means. And when I think about what began to occur in my life in September of 1992, it can't be described as anything else, because up until that very moment, I had done nothing in my life to deserve what was about to begin to happen. So it can only be described as an unearned gift that I got. And most alcoholics you talk to, and when you compare what it used to be like and what it's like now, and you start looking back on it, you have to say to yourself, it is absolutely an unearned gift. The grace of God entered in. And this process begins. And I began to discover that all my life I had been so self-centered and selfish that I had this core of darkness that was within me that would not let the light of understanding enter. It would always hear, you know, the universe hasn't changed. But I have begun to get away
chunk, clear all that mess out so that the sunlight of the Spirit can shine on me and through me and in me. And that's what the process is about. And it begins somewhere. Everything has a beginning. Recognizing the problem, and the second step is the real answer to alcoholism, a belief and a power greater than yourself. The problem, alcohol. The problem is the allergy and the obsession, and the solution to that is a belief in a power greater than yourself. That's the party line of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not to say that all alcoholics have to get sober in AA, but that's our party line. Step one is a statement of the problem. Admitted that we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. That is a statement of the problem. We have enough information given to us now that we can say, yes, that's it. And then they say, those who have recovered, that since we came to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we've been restored to sanity. We were able to break that obsession that returned us to drinking. So therefore, we've never set off the allergy again. See, alcoholics, I'm not cured. I have been restored to sane, rational thinking with respect to alcohol. But if I put a drop of alcohol in this system right now, that allergy would just take right off. I'd be drunk in a short period of time. That's alcoholism as I understand it. So what I've been restored to through the grace of God and through the power of God is the sense of that I don't have to do that anymore. God's in charge. I want to share with you before I finish a story. You're talking about the power of dreams and visions and how it can be. Many of you folks saw the movie Field of Dreams. Not too many of you saw the Field of Dreams? Field of Dreams. Okay, good. You'll enjoy this. The question is, have you ever thought about how powerful thoughts or dreams or visions can really be once we put them into motion? You see, what good is your dream or vision if you sit on your haunch? Not very much. We're talking about putting these dreams and stuff into action. A writer by the name of W.P. Kinsella sat in Calgary, Canada, and had a thought. And this was his thought. What if an Iowa corn farmer had a dream, and combining that dream with action, he was able to reunite a father and a son, one of whom was dead, for a game of baseball? Well, Kinsella did just that. He did something about his thought and his dream and his vision. He wrote a novel called Shoeless Joe. That was what it was called. The book was read by a film director by the name of Phil Robinson. Without these two folks ever meeting, the dream was passed successfully one to another. Robinson's dream was to write and direct a film based on this book, Shoeless Joe. And his dream also, his vision, was to see Kevin Costner play the farmer. He successfully communicated his vision to Costner, who helped pass the dream along to some money people in Hollywood, and they raised the money, and they produced this film. And they called it Field of Dreams. It was a great film, made lots of money, and even received an Academy Award nominee. Well and good, but the power and thought of that dream and vision didn't end there. The farm on which the film was shot is owned by Don Lansing. Since the film's opening, thousands of people moved by the power of a dream have traveled to Dyersville, Iowa to see that field and to play a little baseball, and some even got married at home plate. But mostly they were there to affirm that dreams can and do come true. But the story's still not over. I hope I can do this. Here's a letter that Lansing received. Dear Don, you don't know me. My name is Jim Bond. My son Matt and mother-in-law, Lena Blaha, died in the crash of United Airlines Flight 232 in Sioux City on July the 19th. This past spring, I had taken my son and family to see the movie Field of Dreams. We loved the movie. I had no idea that the field was still there. I figured that after the filming, it had been replanted. To my surprise and delight, I read an article last evening in our Pittsburgh Press newspaper that you have been maintaining the field. How long do you plan to maintain it as a baseball field? Will you still receive visitors next summer? We're planning to visit Sioux City next summer for the anniversary of the crash and would have loved to stop and visit the field. Matt was 12 and loved baseball. So do I, as my father did before me. I've always coached Matt's teams, and for the past 6 years, we've had a great time enjoying each other and baseball. As you may know, the plane crashed in an Iowa cornfield. I found the whole idea very ironic. The story of an Iowa corn farmer who plows up his cornfield to make a baseball field, where dreams come true in my son, who loved baseball, dying in an Iowa cornfield. My dreams came to an end. When I was in Sioux City after the crash, I stayed at Briarcliff College, and from my room, the most prominent object in the landscape was a baseball field. I couldn't stop thinking about the movie, The Crash in the Cornfield in Iowa. There was a message there. And when I read the article last evening, I knew I had to visit the field. Please let me know of your plans for the field. I hope I will have a chance to walk with my son one more time. A single thought by a writer living in Canada, becoming a dream, inspiring millions and giving comfort to a family in Bethel Park, Pennsylvania. Thus, the power of a dream. So create your dreams. Create your visions. This is the weekend to do that. A very powerful story. So we'll take a 15-minute break and come back. Thank you.